Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. It was a shortened holiday trading week, chock full of news on inflation and big bank earnings, while the war in Ukraine marked the beginning of its eighth week.
With that as our backdrop, coming up, we're going to hear from the former finance minister of Ukraine as the Kremlin sees peace talks at a dead end.
Tim, also ahead, the CEO of Lamborghini on his company's response to that war in Ukraine and the luxury car maker's plan to deal with rising prices and supply chain snags.
And speaking of cars, our cover story in this week's double issue of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine looks at Ford's plan to tackle Tesla's dominance when it comes to electric vehicles.
All of that to come. We begin with the ongoing war in Ukraine. Natalie Jaresko is the former Ukraine Minister of Finance. She held that post from 2014 to 2016 during the initial Russian invasion occupation of Ukraine.
She currently serves as Executive Director of Puerto Rico's Financial Oversight and Management Board. She joined us to discuss the future of Ukraine's economy with Russia reportedly set to ramp up attacks on eastern Ukraine.
Ukrainians are actually, you know, facing this with immense courage, and that courage is leading them to start rebuilding. So even in the towns of Irpin and Bucha that have been destroyed recently, the work has begun already to remove debris, to build back the bridge that had been blown up, to restore, rebuild electricity, heat, and water. The government is focused on getting planting started. This is the spring planting season for agriculture. As you know, Ukraine is one of the largest agricultural exporters in the world. And businesses are moving facilities to western Ukraine, where the war has not had as much of an impact, and restarting manufacturing to the extent that they can. And so what you're seeing is this kind of response to the horrors and the tragedies with even greater courage and intent to rebuild, renew, and normalize. And so I think it's an amazing combination of human dignity and courage.
It's like hard to even get your head around that, right? I'm kind of in awe, right? That they're planning for the future and, you know, moving forward with so many questions still yet to be answered. Natalie, I know your focus is, you know, economic and financial situations, but obviously all of that weaves into politics, military, economy. It's all interwoven. Having said that, how do you see this situation overall? Is the West at war with Russia already?
Well, I think the important thing, Carol, is that Putin is at war with the West already, and he always has been, and he's been very clear about it. And so whether or not any of our Western allies believe that they are or not, the fact is that Putin believes he is. And so we are all in this together. This is about his attempt is not only to destroy Ukraine, which is clear, a genocide of the Ukrainian people, which he's had published in articles, but it's also about destroying the liberal world order, the democratic world that we all take for granted every day and that enables us to live in peace and freedom. And so we are fighting an autocrat who wishes to destroy our system.
So,
and that's why you know, in the end, it really is up to all of the allies, up to the democratic nations of the world to support Ukraine in this battle, because Ukraine has to prevail. If Ukraine does not prevail, we, as a democratic world, do not prevail.
At this point, can the Ukrainian president say, yep, I'm willing to give up this? Or if he does, is that a loss for the West overall? And then it just means we will probably see President Putin come back in another aggressive mood sometime in the future.
Well, I think that that's exactly what's happened. We all kind of said, just sit back. After he invaded and illegally annexed Crimea, then he invaded Donbass. Mm-hmm. We held them to the line for 8 years, but the war continued, and it was not enough. Putin's aims are not territorial. Russia is an enormous country. It doesn't require any more territory for its population or for its economy. This is not about territory. And I think the core thing for Western countries and for all of us is to enable Ukraine to prevail. And that, you know, that doesn't mean that there shouldn't be diplomatic talks, but it means that we should focus on giving Ukraine the weapons they need to defeat and to prevail in this war, the sanctions to reduce the Russian ability to finance the war, you know, getting our businesses to boycott the Russian economy and not finance this war against Ukraine. And then with that leverage, when they're prevailing, talks can take place and something can be achieved in those diplomatic talks, so be it. Peace is always welcome. But the first thing to focus on is not the talks and the outcome of the talks. The first thing is to focus on getting Ukraine strong enough to prevail with weapons, sanctions, and boycott, and then hoping that that enables talks to be successful.
Hey, Natalie, does anybody anymore stand between the world and Vladimir Putin?
Does anyone stand in between? I think there are those who are trying not to choose, and I think that it's quite sad. If you look at a country like India, one of the largest, greatest democracies in the world, they're abstaining on critical UN votes, and they are continuing to trade with Russia. They're continuing to buy Russian oil. They're continuing to avoid applying any sanctions.
That was Natalie Jaresko. She's the former Ukraine Minister of Finance.
Tim, she's got a fascinating background story.
Yeah, she does. You know, she was born here in the U.S. to Ukrainian parents. She was educated here in the U.S. After college, she worked for the U.S. government, but then moved to Ukraine, and she was working there with a hedge fund for years.
Yeah, so her insight on Ukraine is just incredible. Find out the latest, though, on the war in Ukraine. Just head to Bloomberg.com. Coming up next, we're going to turn our attention to the world of big tech and a big name in the world of Twitter. It's not, here's a hint, well, I'm just going to tell you, it's not Elon Musk. We're actually talking about Jack Dorsey. Remember him?
Yeah, you know, he and Elon Musk starting to see eye to eye when it comes to one thing.
Kind of bosom buddies,
Bitcoin,
huh?
Right?
Yeah.
Why the ex-social media boss is now trying to become Bitcoin's spiritual leader. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
All right, for all of you who've been listening and watching Bloomberg and reading stories on the Bloomberg Terminal, you know that Wall Street investors have complained for years that Jack Dorsey has been unfocused and unsuited to managing publicly traded companies.
Well, Dorsey apparently agrees with some of his critics. The CEO of Block, that's formerly known as Square,
Thank
I still
you
call
for that.
It. Square a lot, Carol. It's hard for me to call Meta Facebook, too, or Facebook Meta, that is. So you can tell. An ex-CEO of Twitter as of late last year, he's got no intention of focusing, though, on his duties in the C-suite. Instead, he's become obsessed with Bitcoin.
Just a little bit. For more on why Elon Musk's buddy is gazing into the future with laser eyes, we turn to Bloomberg News technology reporter Kurt Wagner, who joined us along with Bloomberg Businessweek editor Jill Weber.
He is going all in on Bitcoin. The artwork in the story is amazing. We get the big red laser eyes.
Those aren't real?
Well, you know, maybe not. Not yet, though. The implant phase might still be coming, except on Twitter. But Kurt, what is it all about? Like, what led to this transformation? I mean, obviously, he just left Twitter just not that long ago, and in that time, he has gone full Bitcoin.
Yeah, I think what started this whole idea was sort of looking at, you know, what comes next for this guy, right? I mean, he's founded these two really successful companies. He's kind of a controversial guy. He's sort of, despite all that's been written about him and how prominent he is publicly, he still feels a little misunderstood, right? And so there was this idea as I was going into this, like, okay, what's the next phase of Jack's life? And every single person I talked to was just like one word, Bitcoin, right? Like, he is just fully invested. He's emotionally invested. I got the sense that was maybe even why he left Twitter, was that he was just no longer interested in kind of dealing with the headache of running that company. And he was like, why would I do this when I could be doing Bitcoin instead? And so this whole kind of, focus on Bitcoin started to really materialize. And then as I started talking to people about why he was into Bitcoin, I feel like that's where it all started to fit into place here. It just fits a lot of the things that he truly cares about. And you know, it's just he's become the face of this kind of movement, and I just find it really interesting.
And we've said Bitcoin, it full Bitcoin, but not full crypto, right? Why is he so for Bitcoin, but maybe not the rest of the landscape?
That's right. Yeah, he in fact he tweeted, I don't like cryptocurrencies, which is kind of funny, right? Because he's the face of probably the most prominent one. But you know, for him, one of the things that's so appealing to Bitcoin is this idea of real decentralization, right? There is no company that controls Bitcoin. It's not regulated by the government. These are all things that he is, believe it or not, against, even though he was just recently the CEO of two publicly traded companies. He's just very against this idea of authority and power being controlled by any one person or company. And so I think that appeals to him with Bitcoin in particular. And I think what he sees is a lot of these other cryptos are being backed by, you know, venture capitalists, Andreessen Horowitz being the most famous one. And he sees this idea of like, hey, people think these things are decentralized, but really they're being controlled by all the same VCs and power brokers that kind of control the internet today, right? And so that's why he's so focused on just this Bitcoin thing. And he kind of feuds with a lot of the people who are invested in type, you know, Web3 type technology.
Yeah, I do particularly like the you know, that part of the narrative, right? The idea that people in Silicon Valley who, you know, from an outsider's perspective would for years be aligned or disagreeing on this point, Kurt. When it comes to Jack Dorsey and Square, though, the company now known as Block, how does he make this happen at Block when it comes to Bitcoin?
Yeah, I mean, Bitcoin has kind of been infused into all of the different parts of the business, right? For everything from Cash App, which is like the main, it's sort of like a Venmo competitor where you can send money to people. You can also buy stocks, but you can also buy Bitcoin. And there was over $10 billion worth of Bitcoin purchased through Cash App last year alone. And so that's kind of the consumer element. And then they have these teams internally that are working on all kinds of different Bitcoin technologies, right? Like making it easier for someone to convert their fiat currency, their US dollar, into Bitcoin, for example. And so I think when it came down to it, again, having talked to so many people who worked for him, I think he's sitting here, he's like, okay, here's my passion, right? Bitcoin is this thing that I just truly love. It doesn't really fit into Twitter all that much. It's not, you know, yes, there are elements of it that could eventually move to social media, but it doesn't fit naturally in the way that it does with Block, with a financial services company. And so I think for him, you know, when it ultimately came down to, all right, where do I want to spend my time? I think that's one of the reasons Block won out.
Kurt, I just have to say, first of all, I love the pictures of Dorsey 2009 versus 2021 with the beard, because it's quite a transformation. Having right? said that, yeah. Is Bitcoin going to be his downfall or, you know, a great new awakening for him? Because I've got to think, as you write about some of the activists, they've just got to be watching closely.
Totally. Well, I think he saved himself a little bit by leaving Twitter, right? Because it became clear that this was, we described in the story as his side hustle. And I think it was starting to cause problems for people at Twitter, especially because there, maybe the business wasn't quite as successful. And so all of a sudden you look around and say, well, why is Jack spending all his time doing this other thing? That's a problem. Now, at Block has been doing better. So up until now, you know, he hasn't really been forced to choose. And again, because he's incorporating Bitcoin so much into the business, I wonder if that buys him a little bit of wiggle room to really focus on this. But I think, you know, long term, this is what makes it so fascinating, right, is that all the people we spoke to were really like, the one thing Jack is great at is predicting the future, right? Like, he's not really necessarily going to be a great manager on a day-to-day basis. He's not going to give you great directives on a day-to-day basis, but he looks 5 years into the future and he can see things that we can't. And right now he sees Bitcoin. And I
find that part of the story just so, so good. Like, there's this line that you have, having a chief executive officer who's ambivalent about being chief and not crazy about executing comes with serious trade-offs. Based on, you know, you had so many interviews, like, talk to us more about Jack Dorsey as a aloof manager. And if you can mention the birds, that'd be great.
I'll start with the birds. You know, part of why the, you know, activists had so much success at Twitter is that there was this perception that Jack wasn't really focused, right? Not really paying attention to his job. And that he wanted to work from Africa, you may recall, for 6 months. And that happened right before the pandemic. He never got to go because of the pandemic, but he still kind of worked remote for the entire pandemic. And he was in Hawaii a lot, and there were chickens in the background of his video calls. He was on a Goldman Sachs call, and there were, you know, songbirds chirping in the background. So, like, he still gets to kind of go and, like, live this life wherever he wants to and lead that way.
That was Bloomberg News technology reporter Kurt Wagner, along with Bloomberg Business Week editor Joel Weber.
Still ahead on Bloomberg Business Week, how rising interest rates and market volatility are affecting New York City's luxury housing market.
Find out who's buying and how much they're shelling out. This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
All right, so a big story in a lot of our conversations focused on inflation, what the Fed is going to do. That was all this past week. And with the Fed set to pick up the pace of interest rate hikes this year, home buyers can expect to feel the squeeze. Yet, Tim, people shopping for housing in New York City don't seem too concerned.
Barbara Fox is president of the Fox Residential Group. It's a small boutique brokerage firm that specializes in the sale of upscale residential properties in Manhattan. And she says, well, business, it's pretty darn good.
Actually, the market is just on fire right now. And as a real estate professional, we move fast when the market is so good. It's really amazing. We're having the biggest problem we're having right now is supply. I mean, all of the supply has been absorbed. Not all of it, but much of it has been absorbed. And it's pushing the prices higher again, and it's really like a crazy market.
So who's buying and how are they buying? Is it all cash deals?
Well, that's the interesting thing. You know, Manhattan is its own animal, and I think about half of all of our deals are all cash deals. So that means that's good news in that the higher interest rates, which is sure to come, will not particularly affect us. And we find that when the stock market is mushy, or whatever you called it, the real estate market tends to be really good, in that people use that as an investment vehicle rather than the stock market. So, you know, right now there are a lot of things pointing very positively in the direction of investment in real estate.
So back to that, who's buying and is it all cash deals?
Sorry. Who's buying? Americans are buying. I just spent the day showing apartments to somebody from Texas and somebody that's moving in from California, and there are a lot of Americans around. I'm not seeing a lot of foreign investors, even though I think that there's going to be a lot more coming forward in the future. And they are, by and large, the big ticket items particularly are all cash deals.
Hmm. Hey, Barbara, I mentioned you've been doing this for decades. You created Fox Residential Group back in 1989 as a boutique real estate firm. You've seen a lot of cycles when it comes to real estate in New York City. And I'm wondering what happens after you start to see a market this hot. Are you seeing any warning signs right now? What comes next? When does the market cool down? Or is this time different?
Well, it's interesting. I don't know whether it's different yet, but I'm sure we'll find out. But what happens is that our market has historically been very cyclical with regard to the seasons. Spring is usually a very hot market. Fall is a hot market. The dead of summer, July and August, are pretty slow. But in the last year, for example, one of our biggest months the whole year was July. So, yeah, it's just everything is sort of, you know, topsy-turvy now, and we don't really know where it's going. I think that with the interest rates increasing at this point, I think that people are going to try to get into the market now as soon as possible, because they know that they're going to be the people that are borrowing are going to want to be able to get the lowest interest rate possible, and that may be a little bit of an impetus for people to buy now in the next 6 months to a year.
Don't you think, though, for the deals that aren't all cash, the stuff that could be maybe sub 3 million, sub 2.5 million, are those going to get hit by rising interest rates?
I think they're ultimately they will be hit if the interest rates go up considerably. But, you know, it's New York is very strange in that we get used to things. And we will get used to the higher interest rates. I was in the business when the interest rates were 18%, and we were selling like crazy. So, you know, it's everybody gets accustomed to the rising interest rates, and they adjust to it. And it's just like the extra taxes that we have to pay on the sale of real estate. You know, it looks terrible when they're first instituting these fees, but everybody gets used to it and they just pay it.
How has the pandemic impacted your market?
It's had a huge impact. A lot of people did leave the city, and a lot of people left the city, left their old apartments and sold their old apartments and then bought pied-à-terres in the city. And I think we're seeing a lot of that right now.
And that was Barbara Fox. She's president of the Fox Residential Group.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up next, the new president of the New York Stock Exchange on technology as a literal hedge against market volatility.
Yeah, we've just seen a tad amount of volatility this year, to say the least.
Yeah, wild quarter.
Yeah, absolutely. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
More than $3 trillion were erased from bond and equity values in the first quarter as the Federal Reserve raised interest rates for the first time since 2018. Tim, it was a lot.
Yeah, it was a quarter when we saw the NASDAQ 100 and the Russell 2000, each with bear market declines of 20%. Also one in which the 60-40 portfolio model fell for the first time in 2 years.
For a lot of investors, it was the first time they saw a lot of volatility. It was everywhere. And that was top of mind at the recent Bloomberg Live Wealth Summit, where I caught up with the president of the New York Stock Exchange Group, Lynn Martin, and Catherine Keating, CEO of Investor Solutions and Wealth Management at BNY Mellon.
Yeah, so volatility obviously is driven by uncertainty, and I think it's fair to say that with the worst global health crisis in 100 years, with the first serious ground war in Europe in 80 years, with the worst inflation in 40 years, and the tightest labor market any of us, I think, have ever seen, there's a lot of uncertainty out there. And so, you know, you focus on what you think will guide you going forward. And so what do we really focus on? We focus first and foremost on inflation and interest rates. Interest rates are the foundation for valuing all financial assets. We focus clearly on geopolitics. We did not anticipate this event in February. Normally, a geopolitical event, markets tend to respond, you know, tend to go down and then rebound very quickly. That's what happened after 9/11. And actually, you did see the market. It was a tough quarter, but it was a better March than February. We look at confidence, right? Because what causes recessions? It's behavior. So we look at CEO confidence, consumer confidence, and we see that in a relatively mid to high range, but coming down, So we watch that. And then the last thing we look for, and you sort of hinted at it with commodity markets, is, you know, we look for where could there be leverage in the system? You know, when Russia defaulted in 1998, there was leverage in the system. It turned out it was leverage currency bets. In 2008, there was leverage in the system. It turned out that it was in mortgages. You know, do we see that kind of leverage in the system? Not necessarily, but what are we watching closely? To your comments, commodities. Mm. Commodities. So, and leverage matters because that's what tends to lead to a, you know, more dramatic decline.
Right. So, Lynn, come on in on this, the volatility that we saw in the first quarter.
Yeah, I mean, someone new to her seat, it was a really volatile time to take this seat. And I mean, I look at it from just the intraday swings, the day-on-day swings, and then I also look at it from the perspective of messaging that's hitting our platform. I mean, we had our top five messaging days ever happen this past quarter. Right. And you're talking about half a trillion messages a day that we processed across all of our platforms, which is unbelievable when you think about it. And when you really saw that was when you saw, you know, the 1,100 point swings intraday in the S&P or some of the other markets. It feels as though the market, though, is starting to come to grips with the volatility. They're starting to take a position that perhaps the Fed is going to do what it's been telegraphing it's going to do. I think maybe the Fed raising a quarter basis points in March gave the market a bit of confidence to trust what was being forecasted there. So we do see volatility starting to abate.
Right.
And from my perspective, I have to look at it from two different perspectives. I got to look at it from our markets, but I also have to look at it from the IPO pipeline.
How's that going?
Yeah, and volatility, as you can imagine, when there's a lot of uncertainty in markets, volatility is going to weigh on those companies who are looking to go public because, you know, they're a bit cautious
right.
about bringing their companies to market at a time when they can have these huge intraday and day-on-day swings. A big indicator that the CEOs that I'm talking to who are planning to come to market that they're looking at is the VIX and how that is starting to behave. When you see it go below 20, that's when the CEOs that are in our pipeline are like, yeah, maybe I can now start to think about coming to market.
So and we ended the quarter just around 20.
Correct.
Right.
I think a couple of weeks ago was the first time that we saw a dip below. So having a lot of conversations with those companies that we know are part of our pipeline.
One thing I thought about in terms of the first quarter, there's volatility and then there's chaos, right? We've seen chaos in the financial markets. I mean, let's go back to the financial crisis and other times where you really felt like, oh my God, the system is coming undone. It's an important distinction because I think about the exchange. It functioned, right?
Absolutely. And I think about 2 years ago in particular when you had the pandemic, when we triggered in the US equity markets, the market-wide circuit breakers, which are a halt when the S&P dips below 7%, and then reopens and then further dips. We had to halt the market four times
right.
during that period. We haven't had to halt the market. This is just the market finding its footing. And you know, our job as an infrastructure provider, as a marketplace, is during times like this, we need to remain open, we need to have orderly trading, we need to have efficient trading, because we need buyers to meet sellers, sellers to meet buyers, and to do so in an efficient fashion.
Catherine, come on in on this, because I do wonder, like, was all of a sudden everybody, again, getting to this point of chaos versus volatility, where all the clients at BNY Mellon, you know, calling up and saying, I want cash only.
No, and in fact, what you see is that there wasn't chaos in the markets. It was actually a very interesting kind of leveling quarter because it almost didn't matter whether you are 100% in, you know, stocks, the S&P 500, or 100% in bonds. Your portfolio probably lost about 5%.
Right.
So that's
right.
Not chaos. That's normal.
The 60-40 didn't do so well.
Actually, it was a combination of the two. It didn't have the same, right?
Right.
And so what was unusual about the quarter was it was such a tough quarter in the bond market, right? Because you had interest rates rising so quickly, and then you had something that typically doesn't happen. You had spreads widen at a time when the economy is actually doing quite well, right? Spreads usually widen when the economy is not doing well, but you had both of those at a time that you didn't have enough, the rates were so low, you didn't have any yield to protect you. So we think that is beginning to start to reverse in this quarter, but it, you know, everybody's pretty much in the same position at the end of the quarter. Most likely, you know, your portfolios were down about 5%, and given all of these big uncertain issues out there, that's actually a very resilient outcome.
Well, this is what I wanted to ask you about some of the volatility triggers. Like we mentioned them, geopolitical tensions, China versus the US, China versus the world, you know, inflation, inverted yield curves, innovation disrupting itself. You guys have been moving increasingly into whether it's the crypto world, the NFT world. What among what some might consider volatility triggers kind of concern you the most, Catherine?
So it's the things that I mentioned earlier, right? We can't control any of these things. But I think that there is a path to a soft landing from all of this, and the path probably includes a couple of things. Obviously, it's the Fed tightening rates, but not too much. It is companies doing what companies do, which is managing through this uncertainty. We have, you know, company profit margins at all-time highs. We've seen a tremendous spike in productivity over the pandemic. That helps corporate results, and we need consumers to do what consumers do. And there's an expression, high prices are the cure for high prices to a certain extent. And what we need the consumers to do is shift a bit how they've been spending, which is on goods, right? All the things that people did to work from home and renovate their homes and all of that, and shift a little bit to services. And then I think there is a path to a soft landing from this.
Yeah, I would agree with that. You know, this is not the first time there has been volatility, to your point earlier, in markets and uncertainty in markets. And markets are resilient. And our markets in the U.S. are the envy of global markets, given the access, given the investor protections they provide, given the types of companies and the transparency that those companies provide when they are public.
Right.
So we've been here before, and we've been here under less of a crisis, if you will. This is not the financial crisis. It's not, you know, the pandemic, the start of the pandemic, when there was a tremendous amount of uncertainty.
Uncomfortable.
Yeah, it did.
And volatility doesn't necessarily mean negative returns, right? Mm-hmm. The average intra-year correction of the S&P 500 over the, you know, since the 1980s is about 14%.
One thing I want to ask you, though, when we talk about like inflation, there is a generation of investors that don't necessarily understand high inflation or 70%
we're all
mortgage rates.
Our parents,
yeah, exactly. We did actually a Twitter poll, and I want to bring it up for everybody, because we asked on inflation, can the U.S. return to 2% inflation without a recession? And as you can see from the results, an overwhelmingly response of no, almost 71%. Do you all agree with that? Yes. Do you agree with that? Lynn, do you agree with that?
It's interesting how sentiment tends to drive markets, though, too. And I think that is a new phenomenon that you've seen with social media, and how that perception may be driving different things in markets, different market behavior, as opposed to you know, fundamentals of market. I always come back to fundamentals of economies, and is the economy, does the economy have a capacity for growth? Right. And this economy does have a capacity for growth. However, sentiment has become a very important driver of what you see in markets.
That's New York Stock Exchange President Lynn Martin, along with Catherine Keating. She's CEO of Investor Solutions and Wealth Management at BNY Mellon. For the full conversation and all of the panels from the Bloomberg Wealth Summit, head on over to BloombergLive.com.
And that wraps up our first hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek. Ahead in our next hour, we are talking cars and we are talking wine, but
woohoo!
Not together, of course, Carol.
No.
Our cover story on Ford's plan to challenge Tesla's EV dominance, and the CEO of Lamborghini on the luxury automaker's record year and its newest ride.
And then, Tim, we've got a fourth-generation Argentine vintner on the perfect Malbec wines for any occasion. What I loved about the conversation, first of all, she was doing it from her car. She was pulled over.
That's what you loved about the conversation?
No.
I'll tell you what I loved about the conversation.
Okay. She got into the history, which I really loved about Malbec wines, where they came from. I know what you loved is that we actually sampled some wine.
Yeah, I love that we were drinking wine. We can do that.
We're allowed to do it. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovek on Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, everyone. Plenty ahead in our second hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week, including, Tim, we're kicking into high gear when it comes to the auto industry.
From the Lamborghini CEO talking delivery hurdles to the team from Kelley Blue Book on the New York Auto Show and what shoppers are really buying.
Right. That show is underway. Let's start, though, with our cover story. It's about the new electrified version of the Ford F-150 truck, as the auto giant looks to re-engineer the 40-year smash success of its gas-powered version. This has been such an important car, truck, I should say, to Ford.
Keith Naughton is the person who wrote that story. He's auto reporter for Bloomberg News. He joins us on the phone from Detroit. Keith, I have one very simple question just to get out of the way in the beginning. A frunk. Who would have thought that a frunk would be such a selling point for this vehicle? Please explain.
And not just a frunk, but a mega power frunk, just to be clear.
Okay, thank you.
As we say in the story, Ford went all Texas on it, and they have this 13 cubic foot gaping maw that you can put two sets of golf clubs in. It literally has a built-in ice chest with a drain so that you can do something called front gating, as Ford's top marketing executive said. You can have a party on both ends.
All right. Joel Weber is with us, editor of Bloomberg Business Week. Do you have a frunk, Joel?
I do have a frunk, yeah. I have a Tesla, so I'll admit I'll admit that. I do have a frunk. It might not be as large as the one that's going to be in the F-150. And, you know, when Keith and I first started talking about this story, I just thought, I think this is we talk about business strategy stories a lot at Business Week. This is like a textbook one, right? Like, Tesla has proven over a decade now that the future is going to be electric vehicles, and now comes the rest of the world trying to play catch up to that idea, and along comes Ford with basically the best selling vehicle in America. Americans love trucks. There's no truck they love more than the F-150. The F-150 is like an economy all by itself. And now comes the moment where Ford's going to bet the house and electrify that flagship iconic product, right? So it's about the frunk. The front's cute, but oh my God, it is so much bigger than the frunk, right, Keith? The stakes absolutely for this thing couldn't be any higher for Ford.
Right. Jim Farley, the CEO, called this a bet the company moment. He said, "Does this keep us up at night? You betcha. Because this is the ball game. Because Americans don't really, despite Tesla's success, Americans don't really buy electric vehicles. Only about 3% of U.S. sales were electric vehicles last year. The rate is much higher in Europe and very high in China. But this is the one that could change that, because it is the ultimate mainstream vehicle. If Ford can convince particularly traditional truckers to embrace electrification, then it goes mainstream.
Is it fair, Keith, at this point, is it too early to call it a success? I mean, the pre-orders are pretty much off the charts, and what Ford had to do in order to accommodate that in terms of production.
Yeah, they really weren't prepared for the success of this truck. They introduced it last May in this very flashy ceremony in front of Ford's world headquarters in Dearborn, Michigan. And then immediately, just the reservations were just off the charts. So they reached almost 200,000 before Ford had to stop taking them. They have doubled factory capacity twice. They originally planned to build 40,000 a year. Now they have the capability to build 150,000 a year. And let's not forget, they got a big PR push from President Biden, who drove the truck, floored it on the recommendation of the CEO.
Love
he
it.
Said, "Mash the throttle." And then when Joe got done, he said, "This sucker's quick."
So you've got a huge PR win, organic PR that comes from the president of the United States doing that. The other thing that, you know, Keith, that really is going to be, I think, a PR advantage is the fact that they're rolling this thing out effectively at scale, right? And how does that compare to the rest of the electric truck kind of category, right? Because really what Ford is going for here is not only is it the flagship category, but like how much of the electric truck category can it seize?
Right. Ford really has essentially a first mover advantage here. Instead of like building a brand new electric truck from the ground up, they went back and they kind of retrofitted the existing F-150. The cab, the shape, the design, it will all look very familiar, but that's part of the strategy. They want to keep it familiar so these traditionalists will buy into it. And the only other trucks on the market right now are the relatively low-selling Rivian R1T from the startup Rivian, which starts at around $80,000 a year, or $80,000 rather, I should say. And then GM has its new electric Hummer out, and that's a six-figure truck. So those are small volume trucks. Ford's truck starts just below $40,000. It's basically in the same price range as a regular gas-fired truck. So they're really going for high volume. And, you know, the Chevy Silverado, which is one of its primary competitors, is still a year out. Tesla's Cybertruck, that's gotten so much buzz and was actually introduced before the Ford F-150 Lightning, that's still a year away. And we don't even know when the Ram is coming, which is the other big selling pickup truck in the United States. So Ford has sort of open road ahead of itself to sort of seize the market.
That was Bloomberg News auto reporter Keith Naughton and the editor of the magazine, Joel Weber.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, we're going to stay with cars and what's hot at the auto show in New York City. This is Bloomberg.
The This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
The New York International Auto Show was back this week. It's going for the next couple of weeks. It was shut down, though, like so much over the past 2 years because of the COVID pandemic. Tim, we've got a couple more conversations about the global auto industry, and that's over the next half hour or so.
First up, one with Stefan Winkelmann, chairman and CEO of Automobili Lamborghini, who dropped by to talk about navigating through today's volatile environment and how long you're going to have to wait to get your hands on that Lambo.
You got to be patient.
People are willing to wait, though. It's a Lambo.
I get that.
I can tell you that since 2.5 years, we are in crisis mode, more or less. The pandemic, then the chip shortage, now the war in Ukraine. What I can tell you, and which is for us very surprising, that already in the second part of 2020, the market, our type of market, was coming back stronger than expected. And as we speak, we are selling every day more cars that we are able to produce. So we have an order bank which is longer than 1 year of waiting time.
Is that typical?
This is before 2020. So before the pandemic, it was between 6, 7, 8, maximum 9 months, depending on the model and on the launches. And now this is very good and healthy for a company like ours. But that the market came back so strong and so sudden, this was unexpected. The chip shortage for us, being part of the Volkswagen Group, was less an issue. We were lucky because we are a small manufacturer, so low volumes, high margins. So we got a priority line from the Volkswagen Group. And now the war in Ukraine, for sure, we put our operations on hold in Russia, so we stopped it, and we have an important supplier in the West Ukraine, so we had stop and goes in production for the Huracan, which is one of our models. But now we are, let's say, in a phase where we have 5-6 days of view of what is happening, and we are not losing any production at timing. So this is for us pretty okay. Then it's clear. Stock market.
Did anything slow down in that first quarter because of the volatility?
No, as we speak, I have to tell you, and I'm unable to make a forecast for the year 2022. But as we speak, there is no slowing down on the request for our cars, and this is very positive. We have also to say that there are more people with the money at their disposal in comparison to a decade ago. So And the world is increasing, and they're more benefiting from it. We have a very young customer base, and they're very proud of owning a Lamborghini. We have to keep the promise of always delivering dream cars. This is paramount for the success.
Because of inflationary pressures, the supply chain you mentioned, the chip shortage, labor costs, all the inflationary pressures that we see happening around the world right now, how much have you had to raise prices?
But so far, we have not, let's say, transferred the cost of the material costs, raw materials, to customers. We have a price increase between 1% and 2%, which is not something which is unusual.
Why haven't you passed that along? If the consumer is willing to wait for a year for a Lamborghini,
I'd say you'd have some leverage.
They're probably willing to pay more, 5 to 10% more for that vehicle.
Let's say if this is going to continue, if there is a further increase on the materials, certainly we will be forced to do so. At time being, we have it under control, and I'm happy to say so. But for the future, as I said, that it's very difficult to make a forecast. The future, so the new models, they will have a higher material cost due to hybridization, so batteries and combustion engines together. So there will be a slight price increase, but only due to that.
How is the supply chain at all, though, impacting your rollout this year? Right, you've got a bunch of new models coming. Is any of that being impacted?
No, at time being not. It's clear that it's early to speak about the new geopolitical situation, because today we are not in the new normal. So we have to wait until the conflict is over and what is going to happen. For sure, we are acting global, so we are a company which is only good when we are able to sell worldwide. So we have high investments, low volume, so we cannot flood one market and think that this is the idea of the future. So we have to act global. On the other hand, acting global means also that our supply chain, we cannot just say that we stay in one country. Mm-hmm. So we will see how this is going to happen. Also the pandemic with all the logistic chain was messed up and it took a lot of time to go back to normal. So we have to see how this is going to be once there is a new normal in place. So,
you did suspend sales to Russia, correct? How much of an impact is that for you guys?
But luckily, we can divert the production or the order bank or the cars which we are going to produce or we wanted to produce for Russia into other markets. So we have no losses, and due to the fact that we have this long order bank, we don't have a negative impact.
Will you stay out of Russia?
We will see after the war. As I said, it's very difficult now to make a forecast about what the geopolitical situation is going to be. The longer the war lasts, the more difficult it will be to go back. No, I'm sure about that.
We know some incredibly wealthy oligarchs in Russia have had sanctions imposed on them, not by the United States, but the UK and the European Union as well. If they were to approach you in another country to buy a vehicle, would you sell them a vehicle?
But we have a list, a blacklist of people, and this is part of the business we had also before, and there are all some of these guys on the list, and we will not sell them cars.
Have you been approached?
But not to my knowledge, but we have our dealers, our partners worldwide, so at time being, I don't see that there is anybody.
All right, the hard part's over.
Well, or not. I got one more question. It's similar to what Carol was asking. You know, right now you've suspended vehicle sales in Russia. What would have to happen for you to start vehicle sales in Russia up again?
Frankly speaking, I don't know, because once the war is going to be over, there will be a new situation, and we have to see how the European Union, because we are part of the European Union, is going to react in terms of sanctions, and we will be aligned on what the government is going to tell us.
That's Stefan Winkelmann, Chairman and CEO of Lamborghini.
We're staying with cars next on Bloomberg Business Week, driving around a track at the New York International Auto Show with the cars that seem to be dominating this year's show.
That's coming up. This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
As we've been talking about, the New York International Auto Show off and running this weekend for the first time in 2 years. Things, though, Tim, are a little bit different this year.
Mike Amuzio, video manager at Cox Automotive and Kelley Blue Book, follows all things cars. He joined us in our studio just after walking the floor at the Javits Center.
So in years past, you know, you'd walk to different areas of the auto show and it was just wall after wall of so many booths of static vehicles, and they've kind of changed that. So if you go downstairs now, they've got a track and you can get in, you can ride in the vehicles, even upstairs.
What? Walking by.
I know, indoor vehicles. And this is what you can do when you have electric cars.
You're not I was going to say, are these internal combustion engines that are inside the Javits Center?
There are not. This is part of the electric vehicle revolution, wherein you can have vehicles and not asphyxiate yourself while motoring around the auto show.
Well, Micah, talk to us about this. EVs, we've been talking about it for years, but what's different? Is this the first time the show has done that?
You know, that focus on EVs and especially driving, this is a new thing. And really that's precipitated by a couple of different things. Item number one is that there's just more vehicles available. There's really this proliferation right now.
Right.
I can tell because when I go on new vehicle launches, I drive all the new stuff. There's a lot more electric happening. In fact, if you go upstairs over to the Hyundai booth, they have dedicated a large section of that area to an experience where you can ride in their new Ioniq 5 electric cars. And I drove the Ioniq 5 recently, and it's super cool.
Okay.
It's a really neat.
Okay,
what's the matter,
it's one
Tim?
Thing. It's one thing to be seeing these things at the auto show. It's another thing to actually put a deposit down and wait for that electric vehicle to arrive.
Didn't
because
your
I got to tell.
A deposit deposit
my
down.
Dad is still waiting for his Mach-E. It has been months at this point. In fact, he's actually gotten some very interesting emails from Ford about updates when it comes to, basically, we have no idea when you're getting your car.
As a Bronco owner, I'm familiar with those kinds of updates, but so that it really keys into one of the big issues right now with electric cars and anything electrified, even hybrids. They are the ones with the tightest constraints in terms of supply. And so there's a lot of interest in electric cars right now. There's huge demand and they just cannot meet that demand.
Is that because of what's going on more broadly with supply chains or something specific to EVs?
Yeah.
And I also do wonder about manufacturers being very careful. I'm thinking about just-in-time inventory and all that good stuff, making sure that they're not overproducing.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of different dynamics at play. I mean, just getting the production up to speed for these new kinds of vehicles is a challenge in and of itself. And then if you think about the vehicles, like the one I was driving, the Hyundai Ioniq 5, or I also drove the Kia EV6 recently, part of being an electric car is not just being electrified, but it's also looking electrified and giving an electrified experience and having big screens and advanced technology and driver assist systems. And all of that stuff requires those microchips that are still in such short supply.
Okay, so when do we start to see you actually be able to buy an EV and get it? When does the supply chain start to ease?
Walk in the showroom, get the car, drive it out.
I mean, that's how it used to work with vehicles until, you know,
until that Elon dude, right?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I guess Elon, when it comes to actually walking into a showroom and walking out with a car, right? You're doing that online now with Tesla.
Yeah, so the dynamic that we have now is that some dealers will get you a vehicle if you've got a lot of money to spend over MSRP. So it really depends on how much you want to spend and how much you're willing to wait. But the supply chain should start to open up. Everything I'm hearing is going into 2023. That's when the microchip shortage is going to start to mellow. So it's not like this is a short-term dynamic. We are kind of stuck with it. But so that kind of leads to an interesting dynamic that we've seen at Cox Automotive. We did some research into.
Did you have some coffee before you walked in here?
He's having tea right now, Carol.
Whoa. Watch my videos. I am always like this. But.
I love it. I'm just like, whoa.
No, I'm going to dial it back like 20%.
You don't
want you guys to be comfortable while
stay
I'm doing
caffeine.
My thing.
We love.
Yeah. Go to 100. It's cool.
Well, what we had noticed in our Cox Automotive study is that people are willing, 42% of car shoppers are willing to delay their purchase. And I have two great anecdotes for that.
So does that mean they're making the order
they
or no?
They're ordering their vehicle and waiting until it will arrive. And oftentimes they're doing that just because the vehicles aren't available or because they can find a dealership that will sell at MSRP, but only if they wait.
It's one thing to do that if you're a Lamborghini, right? And we talked to Lamborghini's CEO, Mr. Winkelmann, yesterday. And he said that their time for waiting for a Lamborghini, if you're a customer who puts an order in, it went from, you know, roughly 7 to 8 months, which is pretty typical for Lamborghini, up to a year at this point. But he's not concerned about people going elsewhere because, hey, if you want a Lamborghini, you're going to wait for Lamborghini. But can you say the same thing about cars that are more of a commodity?
Yes. Yes, you can. My friend Mary, who lives in Denver, put in an order like 3 days ago for a Toyota RAV4 Prime. That's her plug-in hybrid. She was told it's going to be either 8 months to 2 years. So, yeah. People will wait.
That's Micah Muzio, video manager at Cox Automotive, and Kelly Bluebook.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Still ahead, we wrap up with a history lesson, a new book, and a sampling of some great Malbec wines.
Yeah, it's the weekend.
It is.
This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Well, this week we thought we would wrap up with something fun, really perfect for the weekend. We're going to talk about wine.
Hey, that's okay with me.
You're okay
with that? You
don't
have to save wine for the weekend. You can drink wine other days, too.
I've heard that.
Well, we recently had the pleasure to speak with a fourth-generation Argentine vintner, physician and author. Her name, Laura Catena. Carol, she's managing director at Catena Zapata Winery. She's also the author of the book Malbec Mon Amour.
And we began our discussion by asking about the impact of climate change in Mendoza. That's where her family's business is based.
You're seeing a lot of Malbec, which is our signature variety, but we also make many other wines, you know, Cabernet Sauvignon, Chardonnay. We make Pinot Noir. And what's characteristic about our wines, they're from high altitudes, so they have a long time to ripen. So they're very rich, but because of the long ripening time, they're very smooth. So this is the characteristic of Argentinian wines.
All right. And I don't mean to get so serious on you, but I know that we've done a lot of reporting here at Bloomberg, and we've got a lot of time to talk. But climate change, how is that impacting you guys, if at all?
Well, for sure, there is warming all over the world, a little less in the southern hemisphere than in the north. But the main thing is that my father, he moved most of our vineyards to the high altitude regions about 30 years ago. And there is cooler climate here. He was looking for a place to make more mineral, high acidity wines, more age-worthy wines. But he also found this place that is more resilient with climate change. So it is an issue for vineyards all over the world, but we are in a very good position because of the high altitude and the cool climate at the high altitude.
But what are the changes that you have seen over four generations of making wine? I mean, there must be some climate changes, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, the bigger issue in Argentina is not the temperature. It's actually the water, because we have the glaciers of the Andes that the native peoples of Argentina created canals to irrigate. And that's why we can have farming. That's why we can grow vineyards and orchards. And we are a farming place. And there's less and less water from the glacier. So we're working a lot on, you know, how to capture water, how to use less water. That is the bigger issue for us in Argentina, water.
You know, what's interesting too, and I think about the process, how technology is increasingly, you know, Laura, playing a bigger role in something like when it comes to running a winery or running a vineyard. How has that kind of impacted what you guys do as well?
Yes. So, you know, there is this vision of winemaking as everything's done by hand and people are harvesting by hand and they're sorting out the grapes and then you're stepping on the grapes with your feet.
I was going to say, I love Lucy, right? We all went there, right? It's a lot more high tech though, right?
Yeah. And there's a lot of these beautiful traditions. And my philosophy, you know, I'm a medical doctor. And so for me, people are very important. And that's one of the issues. A lot of the people want to move to cities. This is happening all over the world, in all the wine countries. You know, it's happening in California, in Australia, in Europe. And what I say is, let's use technology when it helps us stay in better health as people. So for example, a lot of hand harvesting, if you were doing that every year for 4 months, you would start having severe back problems.
Yeah.
So so actually sun machine harvesting is good. And actually when it rains a lot, you can't harvest by hand. So I'm a big fan of using, you know, we use robots to lift big boxes filled with glass. Of course we should use those robots. We don't want people, you know, injuring their backs. So my view is, let's keep the typicity of the wine, you know, keep the different parcels, the different altitudes, the single vineyards. Like, the diversity of wine that you see today is unprecedented. You know, there's more great wine out there than there ever has been. But let's also take care of the people who work in the vineyards and in the land and use the technology to make their lives better. And that's my goal here.
What inflationary pressures are you seeing across the industry?
You know, in Argentina, we have 50% inflation.
It's crazy.
So I always say, it's not that bad for you in the U.S. So
yeah, that's a good point.
You know, we're seeing, you know, our importers, they're having to pay more for shipping. It's hard to get the containers. We're having to pay more for glass. You know, we're having to pay higher salaries. So there are definite inflationary pressures, but I can tell you that it's worse for us in Argentina than for you in the U.S., if that makes you feel any better.
You know, it's funny that you say it, because we do talk about that global perspective of, like, really understanding it.
You know, Malbec is a very, very ancient grape, just as old as Pinot Noir. It's actually an older grape than Cabernet Sauvignon, for example. It's been around since the Roman times. It was described by the Romans when they walked through France. And then it was very important in the Middle Ages. There was this queen called Eleanor of Aquitaine who brought it from France to England. And then it was also very important in Bordeaux, where all these famous Grand Cru wines from Bordeaux come. And it's part of the blend there. But it came to Argentina in the middle of the 19th century. And now it's more famous from Argentina than from France. It's the variety that's the flagship variety of Argentina. And it's known for its very dark color. It used to be called the black wine, very rich flavor and smooth tannins. And, you know, it's the grape that my great-grandfather, who came from Italy, first planted in Argentina in 1902.
Oh.
That's why I'm the fourth generation making this wine. And the Catena Malbec is a high-altitude blend. And it might be, you know, our most sold wine in the world, this Catena Malbec. What do you think about it?
I really like it.
Are you a red wine? Because I'm a big red wine drinker.
Oh, yeah, I
are
am you? Too. It's not like I know anything about wine, despite the fact that I grew up in a wine region of California, but I know what I like, and this is good.
Laura, what I will say is I'm a big Cabernet drinker, and I want to say 10 years ago, 7 years ago, started drinking a lot of Malbec, and I love it. This is really
good. Yeah, it has the power of the Cabernet, but the smoother tannins, and mm-hmm. it's just a different thing. I mean, I also really love Cabernet, and we make a wine that's a blend of Cabernet and Malbec that I also love. But I think that Malbec on its own is just delicious, and it's really easy to pair with so many different kinds of foods.
And that's the thing I think I like about it is I'm not a very traditionalist, like if it's fish, it has to be white, or if it's meat, it has to be red. But I just like red, so I just drink red with everything. But Malbec in particular, I find I can kind of, you know, pair with almost anything, which is just nice.
Yeah. But you know why that is? That's because it has good acidity because mm-hmm. of the high altitude, because it's not too hot. And then it's got these smooth tannins. So even with something that, you know, has some bitterness or it's really fatty, you know, the smooth tannins and the acidity cut through it. And that's why, you know, I love what you're saying, that you compare Malbec with almost anything. And that's why.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk price here, Laura. I'm just curious, a bottle of this, this is the 2019, right, Carol?
Yes.
This 2019, yeah. How much does it run you?
So that should be around $22, $25.
You know, it's funny. Tim and I, Laura, were talking off air, and I said, I've had some very expensive wine. And, you know, I've also had not so expensive wine. And I feel like there are so much out there now, the offerings from vineyards and wineries, and that this whole idea that you have to spend a ton of money to get a great bottle of wine, it's not true.
Yeah. Well, no, and we also have, you know, a $100 Malbec, a $300 Malbec. But I have to say that I agree with you that, you know, for every day, you know, $20, $25. And then if you want to age something, special occasion, splurge a little bit, you know. I don't know. If there's one thing I will spend money on, it's wine. But, you know, of course, I'm in the industry.
Well, it's wine and shoes. Let's be honest about what matters. Hey, can we talk about can we talk about this book? It is beautiful, and it really is kind of, it's a history, right, of Malbec. Tell us about this and why you wanted to put this out there.
Yeah, so, you know, I felt that people didn't know the history of Malbec. Some people thought maybe it's something new that just showed up because, you know, you didn't see a lot of Malbec in the United States 20 years ago, but it's been around for 2,000 years. And I wanted to shout it out. And I also wanted to explain the subtleties of Malbec from the different vineyards, the different kinds of soils. But I wanted to, you know, the winemaker that I've been working with for 20 years, he and I wanted to tell a story that would also be fun to read, because I think a lot of wine books are really boring and it's too much technical information. So it's history, it's something about flavor, but it's very playful. So he and I are illustrated going back in time and having conversations. And it's a new kind of book. It's an illustrated mix with some text. But there's a lot of really also, you know, important information. But there's a lot of this, you know, more easy to read stuff. And it was reviewed in the New York Times, which is a very big deal in the book world. So I was very pleased about that. And it was a bestseller in Argentina. We already ran out of the first edition.
Laura, who's the book for? Who did you want to write this book for?
I wanted the book to be for people who love wine. You know, maybe if you're just getting started and you know, if you don't know the difference between Cabernet Sauvignon and Pinot Noir, which is perfectly okay not to know that difference, well, probably you should read, you know, Wine for Dummies first, which is actually a great book, by the way. No, I highly recommend it. I know the authors. It's actually highly technical, great book. So maybe read first a basic book about wine. But once you already know, okay, I love Sauvignon Blanc, I love Malbec, you know the varieties, you know some of the regions, then this book is for you. It will also teach you how does a producer make decisions during the harvest? Why do you plant a vineyard in one place and not another? And it's written for an audience that should not be expert. So it's written for a wine lover that knows a little more than nothing about wine.
That's Laura Catena. She's managing director at Catena Zapata Winery. Her book, Malbec Mon Amour, is out now.
That wraps up the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek. Be sure to tune into Bloomberg Business Week. It's Monday through Friday, starting at 2 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio.
You can also watch our daily broadcast on YouTube. Just search Bloomberg Global News.
And check out our Bloomberg Business Week podcast. You can find it at Bloomberg.com, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bloomberg Business Week is available on newsstands now at Bloomberg.com, at BusinessWeek.com, and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
You can also see me on Bloomberg Quick Take. It's available at Bloomberg.com/QT and streaming platforms like Roku TV, Apple TV, Samsung TV, and more. Have a good weekend.
Stay safe, everyone. This is Bloomberg.